Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we help you live green, work green, and earn green. I'm Joan Michelson. We are talking innovation with top leaders and thinkers in energy and sustainability and those who are transforming our world. You benefit from my extensive network of C-level executives, entrepreneurs, artists, authors, government leaders, and journalists, and my many years in the media and Fortune 500 companies. Find us online on greenconnectionsradio.com, iTunes, iHeartRadio, where we come to you from today. Tune in, Stitcher, and wherever you like to listen to your favorite podcasts. You can also join our private Facebook group, which is linked from our website, greenconnectionsradio.com. Innovation in the energy and sustainability space is needed now more than ever as the impact of climate change becomes more vivid in our daily lives and also presents the opportunity to make our lives better, as well as more energy efficient and environmentally friendly. Today, with the new administration seeking to reduce the government investment in these initiatives, according to their proposed budget and rhetoric anyway so far, it's more urgent than ever for innovators to find sources of funding for their early stage businesses. Every business started at the beginning, right? Even Microsoft and Apple and Uber and Twitter started with somebody's idea at a kitchen table or on the back of an envelope. And yet someone somewhere said yes to funding them and helping them through what is called the Valley of Death. I would pose it that there are several of these valleys of death in the course of a startup's evolution to financial stability. One of the most effective sources of innovation-related funding in science, technology, engineering, and math is grants. And one of my favorite grants is the National Science Foundation's Small Business Innovation Research Grant Program. And one of the deadlines to apply for this critical funding is coming up in about 6 weeks, so we wanted to bring you this information in time for you to explore applying. They provide up to $225,000 in grants for their Phase 1 program and up to $750,000 for their Phase 2 grant program and more. So listen up. So what is the National Science Foundation's SBIR program? What does it provide exactly? Which businesses are eligible? What do you need to qualify? We're going to answer those today. So today I'm delighted to introduce you to the best person to answer all these and more. Anna Brady Estevez is the program director for the National Science Foundation's SBIR-STTR program in chemical and environmental technologies. She's especially terrific to talk to about these issues because she has experience on all sides of innovation. As an entrepreneur herself, an investor, an advisor, including with the Boston Consulting Group, a corporate strategist, and she's an engineer. In 2009, Anna was recognized as one of the 30 Kaufman Fellows from around the world for her leadership in innovation and venture capital, and she earned her PhD at Yale in chemical and environmental engineering, where she also held a National Science Foundation Graduate Research Fellowship. So I guess she's come full circle. I could go on and on about Anna, but you get the point. So without further ado, I'd like you to meet Anna Brady Estevez. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, Anna.
Thank you so much, Joan. Very excited to be on your show today and be able to introduce people to NSF's SBIR-STTR program.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. So what types of companies are eligible for the SBIR and STTR grants? And like, what are the criteria?
Sure. So the main criteria is really to be a small business. And just to go back a little bit to what the level of the funding is, 3% of our budget, we're allocating out of our $7.5 billion budget, we're allocating almost $200 million a year to small businesses through this SBIR program. And the companies, something that's a little bit different about NSF's SBIR is that they can be from pretty much any type of technology or innovation. So we have companies, my portfolio is chemical and environmental technologies, we have biological life science companies, IT, semiconductors, we have Internet of Things, educational technologies, manufacturing, materials, smart health. Really, you know, we have several topic areas listed on the website, but the reality is we want the market to tell us what's exciting, so we even have another category. So if it's an area of totally new innovation, even that we haven't funded in the past, we're open to it if there's that commercial potential or potentially that societal benefit. So the main thing is it needs to be a small business, so it has to have under 500 employees. It has to be U.S. owned, so majority U.S. owned. It has to be operating in the U.S. And we're very open to all types of innovation and encourage diversity in terms of types of companies, in terms of types of entrepreneurs. We really want to see science and innovation flourish from all sorts of brilliant minds and, you know, commercially driven people from across the country.
Do the grants provide only the cash, or do they provide, as I recall, they provide mentoring and guidance as well. Is that right?
Yes. So our program is a little bit different from most in that we have full-time program directors. So in terms of how we allocate our time, I mean, definitely trying to, determine which proposals seem to have the most promise in terms of companies that we can provide that grant, non-dilutive funding. That is a big piece of the job, but also working with the portfolio companies once they do receive that grant award, that is a big piece of it. So trying to help them work through different company issues, you know, make introductions where we're able to, and just be supportive of the company. That's, for many of us, our favorite part of the job. And so that is a piece of our program at NSF.
Okay. So, and just to clarify, you said that in 2016, you had roughly 2175 SBIR proposals. What percentage of the proposals do you fund, and how do you determine that?
So it really isn't a set number in terms of what we fund. It's much more based on what the flow is of proposals we get and then the amount of funding that we have. And so the competitive nature really goes up and down based on the number of proposals versus the funding available. In recent rounds, it's been roughly 10 to 15% of the SBIR, STTR proposals. And so certainly it is competitive at that phase one level, but contrasting that with, say, venture funding, which I believe is often lower than 1% of companies that apply, it actually is quite generous. And then that amount of money, the $225K initially, and then, you know, up to $1.5 million total, I think it's very important. We want entrepreneurs to know for the promise of your work, which we're interested in supporting, if you do receive an award, we don't take any percentage of your company. We don't take equity. It's not a loan, so you don't pay it back. It's support that the federal government is extending to try to help catalyze your ability to take your innovation forward and commercialize in the earliest, most risky stages of your venture.
And you don't take any ownership in the IP of the company either, do you?
We don't.
The intellectual property. Okay, just to clarify.
Yeah, we don't take the ownership of the IP.
So are there any restrictions on how they spend the grant money? Can they use it for salaries for themselves, for example, or for marketing? Or does it have to go towards certain aspects of the technology? Or what are the parameters for how they spend the money?
Yeah, so there are some restrictions, and I wouldn't be prepared to probably speak to all restrictions, but I guess the main thing in terms of some of the main questions that you've raised, salary is a great one. That's an important one. It's important for people to earn salary so that they're able to dedicate the time to commit to their business. And we see a wide range of what people think makes sense. Some people take full salary for 12 months of work at the phase one level. Others might say, you know, I only need X months of salary, and they're going to kind of, use the money for other materials or salary of other people that they want on their team. So that's very much the choice of the entrepreneur, and we want the budget to reflect what is best for the company. We are only able to fund the technical work. So what does this mean? This means that we can't fund a CEO's salary to do nothing but business development. So oftentimes those salaries are going to be the principal investigator, the person who's pushing the technology forward, and or perhaps the CEO, and they need to deliver that 40 hours a week of technical work. Most, to get that NSF salary, most entrepreneurs work far in excess of 40 hours a week. So, you know, we think it's great when they want to dedicate those extra hours to business development, commercialization, but our funds can't be directly allocated to that commercialization, those commercialization efforts. So there is that need to do that in the extra hours or to bring in additional funding.
Well, that's interesting because the focus of the NSF grant is to provide, is to help the company commercialize. So why would you not support commercialization efforts?
You know, I think that's a great question. It's our, the limitations of our funding. So we're not actually authorized to support the commercialization funding directly. But I do think that by only requiring people to work 40 hours on pushing the ball forward technically, I think that actually for most of our companies does enable the funding of quite a bit of commercial work, precisely because a lot of people are finding ways to work that into the schedule. And we're not saying that they have to do the R&D work from 9 to 5 or anything like that. So if they want to do business meetings in the middle of the day and then do the commercialization at some other point in the week, we're very supportive of that. So I guess that is just what the taxpayers and Congress gives us the money to do, because a big part of what we're trying to do is de-risk technology innovation, which is which most funders are not willing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's actually what we think is the bigger gap, is the funding for these highly technical, still very risky pieces. And that's our mandate at the National Science Foundation.
Yeah, no, that's good. And that's why you're, that's the valley of death that I mentioned. Absolutely. And yeah, I just want to say for the audience that if you believe these grant programs should continue, I encourage you to write your members of Congress and insist that funding for the National Science Foundation and even the Department of Energy's innovation arm, ARPA-E, and the EPA and NOAA and other clean energy and climate change related and innovation related programs stay in place and actually be increased. So I know Anna can't address that, but I can. So there you go. So what are the trends? You're on the energy side. You're in the thick of it here. So what are the trends you are seeing in clean energy innovations right now?
Well, we really see so much, and I guess in terms of things that we've funded, we really welcome applications from any type of energy or environmental technology, or in my portfolio, chemical technology. So, I mean, we've definitely funded things in energy generation. Those have spanned areas as diverse as solar, wind, oil and gas transformations, geothermal, biofuels, thermoelectrics, waste to energy, waste heat to energy. These are just a few examples. Then we see things and fund things in energy conversion and storage, whether that's batteries, capacitors, whether it's improved engines for that energy conversion, efficiencies and green processes. So whether it's water treatment, green chemicals, agricultural innovations, catalysts, the list goes on and on, and we're definitely seeing a lot also now in terms of sensing and data applications with regards to the environment, energy, and chemical processes. So think big data, IoT, blockchain applications. In terms of some, we're seeing a lot of newer areas right now and potential. Some of that is on the sensing and the data side as it pertains to energy and the environment. We're also seeing the potential for blockchain in terms of distributed ledger technology and what that means for data efficiency, transaction efficiency, what it could do for peer-to-peer transactions. If you think about, you know, just cutting out a lot of inefficiency in global energy and power, but then also having new systems that perhaps facilitate more peer-to-peer transactions. So if you own solar on your rooftop, you can sell potentially in the future to your neighbor, as opposed to having a heavy reliance on centralized systems with the utilities. Those are potential things that could happen in the future. That blockchain is an innovation that initially started out in cryptocurrency, but there's the potential in energy. Some of these areas that we've seen, even on the traditional energy side of the house, more in the oil and gas, we see both cost opportunities in terms of real advantages, but we also see environmental opportunities in terms of making those traditional production practices much cleaner and greener. So one example could be waterless fracking processes, which would both transform the economics and be a lot better for the environment. So, you know, these are just a couple examples of exciting things, and but we're really open to whatever the innovators and entrepreneurs see. So we want to hear what is that value proposition for how it makes something new possible, how it, you know, drastically reduces costs or makes something, just opens up new opportunities.
Are there any companies that you have funded or are funding now that you can talk about as an example?
Sure. I'd be happy to go into some examples. So, for instance, in solar, we have a company that does building integrated photovoltaics. So when we think about solar energy, the Earth receives more energy from the sun, as many of your listeners probably know, in 1 hour than the world's population uses in a year. So tremendous amount of solar energy that's not being harnessed. So when we think about how solar energy is traditionally harnessed in buildings, you think about rooftops. Well, the surface area of a 50-story building is 20 times greater than that available on a roof. So if you think about the opportunity to turn all those windows into effective solar panels, we have a company, for instance, which we funded that lets all the visible light go in. So that still comes into the building and provides that lighting. So you have the fully transparent window, but it absorbs the IR light, which is 56% of the solar energy, and the UV light, which is 9%. So tremendous potential to take the energy that's solar energy that's on those window surfaces and turn that to electricity. Also reduce that heat that would be otherwise coming into the building, so it reduces air conditioning costs. So that's a good solar example. And not to say that there aren't other very promising solar companies in the portfolio. These are just a few examples. Another company in thermoelectrics. So thermoelectrics is when you take differences in temperature and waste heat and you create electricity from that. So in terms of just capturing even a small percentage of waste heat, if we were to capture 7% of waste heat at only 5% efficiency, so an extremely small percentage of the total opportunity, that would be enough clean energy to power 3 million American homes each year.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, if we get into grid management, we also have companies that work on grid management in terms of integration of renewables and storage, offering dynamic efficiency gains, and intelligently routing power. So this has the potential for much more efficient grid management. When we think about how to manage all our energy sources, one of the things that probably comes up for people is energy storage. You know, so precisely when that energy is produced, be it from renewables, that there's somewhere some method of storing that energy for when it's most needed. So one example of that is Imprint Energy. It is a novel zinc battery chemistry that's ultra-thin, flexible, and rechargeable battery. And they propose significant reductions in cost and environmental impact. And the flexibility of those batteries could also be good for wearable electronics, robotics, sensors, displays, and wireless electronics.
So what do these, I love this, you know, and I'm sitting here going, how do these people come up with this stuff?
It's,
I mean,
amazing,
it's just,
it?
You know, this is why I love innovation. This is why I'm an innovation freak, because I just love what the mind comes up with.
And that's why we love having the market tell us, you know, in terms of entrepreneurs and scientists, what they're excited about. And we want to see that innovation and those ideas come from all over the country, people from all different types of expertise, all different types of backgrounds. So, you know, there's some misconceptions. You do not need to be a scientist. You could have any background. It's really just, do you have something that would be a technical innovation that does have commercial potential that would, you know, there is a path to market and you've got a team, or which the team could be one person starting out that wants to bring this forward. And it's just amazing how diverse people from, you know, all over the country, all different types of backgrounds, all, you know, they bring the most amazing ideas that are shaped by their experience and their hypotheses.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you say that, because I worked in big companies for years, and I was always the catalyst for these kinds of conversations. And I've done presentations and keynote addresses on bringing people onto your team who are going to be this spark and this catalyst. It's like if you're interviewing somebody for a job and you say, oh, well, they'll never fit in, hire them for that reason alone, because they're going to be the one who's going to say, well, wait a minute, but have you looked at it this way? You know, have you turned it purple and upside down and inside out? And you know, or what if we tried doing it in super humid weather instead of super dry weather, or, you know, whatever, so that they come up with things that they catch you in your assumptions and they come up with things differently. I mean, that's how I did a lot of growth, for example, at Chrysler. I mean, my boss thought I was crazy half of the time. I'd walk into his office and he'd go, oh, God, here she is. I know you're here to take me out of my comfort zone. Give me a minute. And he'd like grab the arms of his chair, you know. And we did some, you know, pretty wild things. Did I do everything I wanted? No. But that's where those ideas come from. It's just this spark of people talking something out and saying, well, you know, what if we did it this way? And we have to support these people, right? That's how change happens. That's how our lives improve. That's how our lives get better. And that's where we discover the things that we didn't know we needed. So what happens to these businesses once the NSF funding runs out? How are they counseled to prepare for moving forward?
So I'll get to that, but one thing I want to really key in on is just your point on how important it is, these disruptive thinkers. I love that you bring that up. And another thing that I think it's important for potential applicants to know is it's all about the potential that your solution could work. Because, and this is something I tell panelists, is we don't need to think that something's got 100% chance of working or an 80% chance of working. We can fund something that has potentially a low percentage chance of working out technically, because if it does work, it's going to really take humanity forward. It's going to provide us with this amazing option. So, you know, if something's got a 20% chance of working, but it would be transformational, that's something that we can fund. And so I think that's one of the things that's most exciting about NSF's funding. Back to your question, one of the things that is a limitation for us, and I think people understand it, is we can only go up to $1.5 million total, roughly. So we always have the assumption, I mean, in some cases that's enough in IT, but for the most part, there does always have to be that next round of funding, or, you know, the way for the company to finance their path forward. So we definitely are very forthright that it's important to bring in those external investors. And that's something that we give the company a runway of about 2.5, for some companies it's 3 years, depending on how long they take on the phase one, or it could be 3.5 years. But we recognize that other investors need to come in. So it's our financing and working with the entrepreneurs where they're able to de-risk some of those early technical hurdles and make that commercial progress as they're working that on the side, that that hopefully de-risks these technologies to the point where, whether it's venture investors or whether it's strategic investors, are able to come in and do that next phase of funding. And of course, another one that's even better is if you can get sales.
Right. I was going to say, if you can generate revenue, that would be fun too, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Or early sales. And so some companies do really well in terms of being able to pull in those early sales. And then obviously for other technologies, sometimes more financial resources are required to get to those initial sales.
Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, I want to ask you a few questions about you for a minute, which sort of get to kind of career-ish questions. But what inspired you to become a chemical and environmental engineer in the first place?
I think just excitement about science and technology. And, you know, there were a couple, and then just from a practical standpoint, I mean, there were a lot of class requisites for it. So it was one of those things that you kind of, from a scheduling standpoint, needed to start out chemical, because it would have been harder to switch in later. And I really liked it.
Oh, well, that's cool. So, you've had such an interesting and varied career. You've, as I said in the introduction, your path has taken you around really all sides of technology innovation. And a lot of us, I mean, most people don't do that. I mean, whether it's society saying, oh, well, you know, you fit into this, you know, line, so we're going to keep you here, or or employers say that, or we do it to ourselves. I think that's especially true, unfortunately, for women, where we get kind of pigeonholed and don't have the opportunity to stretch and go into other sides. I mean, I have people sometimes contact me and say, you know, I've been in the Foreign Service, for example, and I want to get into the green economy. How do I do it? But you've been on all sides of this. So how did you, this may be an odd question, but how do you think you persuaded people to hire you for roles that you had not held before?
Well, I mean, I think I've definitely worked with open-minded people that, you know, again, we're willing to give those opportunities, but I think it's, I think that you need to have first the desire to want to do it, and then there does have to be a certain tenacity in the case that I think the one of the biggest challenges was actually coming out of the PhD and getting into business and investing, and I think there was a bit of this, well, you're a scientist, you know, you've been in school forever. You know, why would we have you invest? So, and I probably couldn't have gotten into a less technical form of investment straight out of school. But I think it was leveraging, figuring out how to leverage your strength into the thing that you want to go into. So since I had worked in nanotechnology and chemical engineering, and that was a field that was of interest to some people, I was able to make that kind of technical path into investing. And then I think having the investment background was attractive for corporate strategy. And so it's really just seeing opportunities, so also being responsive to what is out there and what could be valuable in terms of increasing ability to solve problems and work with good people. But I think it's also just being, you know, really going after some of those. And I've kind of been in the same space. So I've had a lot of different angles that are all well connected. So a lot of my work has been in strategy and investments, I guess. And much of it has been in the energy and environment space, which I'm very passionate about. I've also had a passion for international work, which really opened a lot of doors for me.
Yeah, I saw you worked in Chile at one point. So I think you touched on one thing, too, that I just want to pull out, and that is passion. I think if you meet with people, especially if you're making a transition, and you come to them demonstrating, without being terribly overwhelming, of course, but demonstrating your passion for it and your commitment to it, I think that goes a long way. Because I think that when we're passionate about something, we're committed to something, we can work through the hard stuff and learn and say, well, okay, I don't understand this part. Can you explain it, right?
And I think another thing that could be helpful to people is also just, and I know I've had challenges with this at some points in the past, but really trying to communicate clearly, because people, when it's a story that's understandable or an opportunity that's well conveyed, people respond well to it. And leaders and people in business are so busy. So, you know, many of us have gotten to the point where we think more in PowerPoint than in, you know, in bullet points. So really having the ability to bring clarity to what the opportunity is something that is, I think, helpful for people in getting opportunities.
Well, as a professional communicator on all sides of the fence, I say hear, hear to that one. So you kind of just did this, but what would you suggest to a woman in mid-career who wants to use her education and experience to make a difference in the clean energy and environmental sector? How would you counsel her to find her place?
That's a great question, and I've thought a lot about this. And so I think it's important for women, and some women might not want to be moving into that top 10%, 1%, or 0.1% of a field. But it is something that I would invite them to think about, you know, whether it's their early career, mid-career, or late career. And also just recognize if that might be your goal, recognize it's competitive. I think early in our career, we have people saying, oh, you know, what do you want to do? How can we support you? And the reality is, when it comes to a top job, other people want that top job. So sometimes there's somebody who wants you to be in that top job, but oftentimes they want themselves to be in that top job. So I think just being comfortable with, if you want to be there, maybe you belong there, but maybe you need to position yourself, really go for it, and have other people that you're allied with help you get there. So, and is it something that you want? I think there's a narrative that in some of these fields that, oh, well, it's so hard, it's so elite, and this is something that even, unfortunately, engineering broadly, I know I've been in the lecture where they say, you know, in engineering, look left, look right, one of you is going to be here in 4 years type thing. And so some people respond well to that and others don't. It's very different than a personal trainer who says, yeah, it's going to be hard, but you're going to do great. You can get in shape. So I think that engineering, finance, entrepreneurship, if these are things that are of interest to people in their career, it's attainable. And so really think about if you want to be there. And and sometimes it's easier than what is portrayed. There was a great book that I'm pretty sure I didn't read the whole thing because, you know, sometimes we can get the messages without reading the full thing. But there was a book called I Know How She Does It, written by Laura, I think, Vanderkam. And she had surveyed women who earn over 100K and also have kids. So there's kind of this perception of, wow, that's so difficult or that's so hard. And what she found is these women were working far fewer hours than they thought. So they were working on average a 44-hour week. They had a lot of opportunities that their job afforded them, a lot of flexibility that their job afforded them. So sometimes there's this narrative, well, if you're successful, your life's going to be really hard. And that's not necessarily what the case is. And I don't remember how many hours they said CEOs worked, but it was so low.
Yes, Sheryl Sandberg points this out in Lean In. She said, you know, the truth is that the higher you go up the food chain, the more control you have over your time because you have other people that you're delegating more things to. And in some ways, you know, you spend a lot of your time waiting to hear back from so-and-so, right? Or waiting for a report about X, Y, and Z. And you're making the tough decisions, however, that's why you make the money because you're, you know, you're taking the responsibility of the bigger, heavier, tougher decisions. But that Sheryl Sandberg makes that point too, that you have more control of your time. You're not as put upon all the time. But I think that's great. And the thing that I think is your career is a model of is try to get experience in as many sides of it as possible. I mean, if I look at what I like to do is help clients kind of re-engineer people who are their role models. So if you look at Mary Barra, for example, Mary Barra didn't go to quote-unquote formal college. What she did was she learned the business from the very, very, very beginning, right? Even her dad was there. So she learned every side of it. She learned engineering, she learned design, she learned marketing, she learned HR. You know, she didn't get, when they put her in HR, she didn't get stuck there, right? And so I think being well-rounded in operations and running the, you know, being a line manager, as they say, having P&L responsibility, learning all sides of it also can, is really important, frankly, to helping you get qualified and be perceived as qualified, which is almost more important than whether you think you're qualified or not. It's whether they think you're qualified to do a certain job.
Right. Another one I think that has been, I think those are all really good points. And another one that I think can be an accelerator in terms of that experience and that learning, particularly in energy, is if you have the opportunity to either, for some people, it's do global work, and for other people, it is just learn about what's happening globally in their industry and in energy. Because what I found, and there's different types of global, so it doesn't mean that you need to go live in another country. There's living in another country, there's having colleagues that you work at with in a global organization that they're over there. There's flyover support where you go into market, you know, for a few days or a few weeks. So there's all different types of global, but in energy, you see things in even just a span of a couple years when you're looking at the entire globe that you wouldn't see in 15 or 20 years in one market. So whether it's, you know, fuel shortages, whether it's huge regulatory changes, whether it's subsidies that were promised evaporating, whether it's new technologies, you know, or like as we're seeing, you know, transformation of energy economics in the U.S., you can see so much if you look across the globe, I guess. So I think that can be an accelerator. Another one that I think is important for people to think about is, and you spoke a little bit about this, is controlling the pace of their career in terms of how much they want to put into it. I've heard, and particularly some more junior women have come to me in the past and said, oh, well, you know, this senior person told me I should work less. And I said, well, you know, if you want to, you can. But if you want to work a lot right now, you know, you should feel free to do that too, because you might not have, there might be a point in a year or in 10 years where you don't have that ability or that desire to dedicate, you know, a 50, 60, 80 or whatever hour week. So do what you think is going to be right for your career. And you don't need to communicate what that is. It might be better to communicate that you're working 80 hours, or it might be better to make it seem like it was 40.
Yeah, just do it, right? And I don't think age or stage of career has anything to do with it. I think it's your own energy level. I mean, I know people in their 20s and 30s who work, you know, or the Energizer Bunny and don't do anything. Or don't do any, you know, on either side is what I'm saying. And then there are people who are, you know, generations ahead of them. I mean, I saw a story in the Washington Post this morning about a guy who's 80 years old and in super duper fitness shape and a personal trainer. And, you know, so it's not about age, it's about, or stage, it's about what you want to do with that time and where your energy is going.
I agree. And that's what I meant more, is that the stage that it makes sense for people is so based on each individual. So if there's ever a time that you feel like you want to do it, you know, it's good to not necessarily be dissuaded. And at the same time, if there are points where you need more flexibility or just dedicate energy to other areas of your life, whenever that is, career is nonlinear. So I guess having that ability to do what you're able to do when you're able to do it is one that I think is helpful.
Yeah, I think it's especially nonlinear for women. I mean, I think I mentioned to you offline that I'm writing a book on women's careers, and I found that women's careers, by and large, are different trajectories than men's. I mean, some of that might be societal conditioning, because men have, you know, been more conditioned to do this linear thing and climb the corporate ladder, as it's called, right? But and I think that's part of it too, just to sort of close out this loop of conversation, and that is that it depends on your goals. I mean, like you said, if your goal is to be the CEO, then you've got to bust your butt some, and you've got to learn all the different sides of the business, and you've got to build your relationships, and you've got to go to the dinners and the conferences and the events, and you've got to network, and you've got to, you know, dot your I's and cross your T's. If your goal is to be an entrepreneur, then you've got other goals. You may be working just as hard, but you might be doing different things with different people at different times. And so you have to base it also on what your goals are and what your goals are right now, because they might change.
And entrepreneurship offers so many paths and so many opportunities. So, I mean, it's just extraordinary in terms of what's possible for an entrepreneur. And definitely for most, it does require a big commitment, but in terms of, there's so many paths to getting to that win. And so it's really something that opens up a lot of opportunity for people. And many feel very passionate about what they're doing. So I think it's a really exciting opportunity for entrepreneurs. And at the National Science Foundation, we definitely want to be there for those entrepreneurs with those high potential disruptions, and help them get through at least the funding stage and some of that mentorship of that early stage of commercialization. So I think it's great, and also just the ability that your success, you know, in some environments depends on a much more limited subset of people, whereas when you're an entrepreneur, you just need to find that traction somewhere in the market and build upon it. So if you can find the customers who believe in you, you don't need to make that sale to everybody. You just need to find that niche.
Well, that's a really good point, and that's a really good point to end on. And I think I can speak for the entrepreneurial community to say we appreciate your being there for us, and we appreciate the National Science Foundation being that support and being that open to new ideas because that's the one spot that's pretty hard to fill. So thank you for doing that. Could you please give us the deadline for the application? I think that you have a deadline in June, right, that's coming up?
Yes, that's a deadline in mid-June. It is June 14th, I believe.
Okay, great. So thank you so much for joining us today, Anna, on Green Connections Radio. Anna Brady-Estevez of the National Science Foundation's SBIR-STTR grant program. That's Small Business Innovation Research Grant Program. We will link to the program's information from our website, greenconnectionsradio.com, where you can also sign up for our newsletter to stay in the loop and find out more about these grants. And we'll also talk about it on our private Facebook group, so be sure to join there as well, and how you can apply. We'll put that information up there. So what did you hear Anna say? Have you received a National Science Foundation grant or an SBIR grant? If so, what was your experience? What was the business? And how did it work out? Are you still going strong? Tell us about it. And what questions do you have for Anna? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson or post it on our Facebook page and like the page while you're there, as well as on our private Facebook group. And email it to us at greenconnectionsradio.com or leave it on iTunes with your review. I'm Joan Michelson. Thank you for joining us. See you next time.
Hi, my name is David Goldberg, president of Edge Studio, a voiceover company. We oversee professional narrators and voice actors for sales videos, training videos, telephone pre-recorded systems, commercials, web videos, and all applications requiring voiceover. And in fact, for over 20 years and in over 100 languages, we have been considered the most trusted and the friendliest leader in the voiceover industry. We're a green company with efforts towards sustainability at all of our studio locations. EdgeStudio.com. Sound people who are happy to help.